Okay, so we are in chapter 13, page 1869. This is the last in-person session. Whatever we do not finish today, I will have to do as a recording and email it out. And I intend to email out, in any case, a summary of Ezra Nehemiah, just some kind of an outline. In general, I feel terrible that we've rushed the last perek because there's so much going on here. The last two perek, really. But such is life, because we have to finish the book. So, Yeshaya. 2 years of Yeshaya, we're going to be doing a roughly one parak a week, and it'll be themes rather than word by word. Okay, but really, I want to finish Ezra and Nehemiah, so that's what we're going to do now. All conversations now turn to Ezra and Nehemiah. Thank you. Page 1869, the opening part of this book, which we did last week, was a bit of a problem. The opening few sentences. Come on. The opening few sentences were regarding the issue of intermarriage and the Ammonia and the Moabia. We had said that they read from the scroll of Moshe, and we didn't understand when this happened. It was a very odd thing. I should go back and just note one thing. Moshe Goldstein pointed out to me in an email. I'm not sure what to really do with the idea, but it is an interesting idea. He looked at the opening sentence from chapter 13, and he noted that it's similar to the opening passage in chapter 6 in the book of Esther, which is a little before this historically, but when the scroll is read before Ahasuerus, right? It's Balayla Hahu that night, and here it starts Bayom Hahu, and the Vayikare, it was read, right? It was read out before him, and here it's Nikra, and then Vayimatzei Katuv, it was found written, here it's Nimtza Katuv Bo. So it's an interesting point. I'm not really sure that I would do anything with the idea other than to point out the interesting correspondence of word. You could make the suggestion that it's a message about a divinely planned reading in the story of Ahasuerus, and that here also it's divinely planned that they should read this and realize what they're doing is wrong. Maybe you can make such an association, but however you read it, the bottom line is that they find out that there's a problem, that there is indeed intermarriage, which we knew already, of course, among the Jews in this space, and specifically there's a concern for Ammon and Moab. And it was very odd. Why are they reading from the scroll of Moshe? Why is this here? And we offered a few different explanations for what the timing of this story and this public reading might be. But the most intriguing suggestion for how to read this is the Malbim's suggestion, which is that you should read the opening 9 sentences of this chapter as a single unit. And in fact, sentences 1 to 3 are really part of what happens in sentences 4 to 9. So in sentences 1 to 3, again, we said they read from the scroll of Moshe. And we talked about the name of the scroll of Moshe already last time. But they read from the Torah, and they discovered written in it that Ammon and Moab are not allowed to marry among the Jews. Even if they convert, they're not allowed to marry those who were born into the Jewish people. Why? We talked about this, the fact that they didn't bring you the bread and water when you were traveling in the Midbar, in the wilderness. And then we get sentence 4. And here we get, I'm sorry, and then in sentence 3 we find out that when they heard this, they separated those who had married in. So again, this could be a throwback to chapter 8, where they had their big public reading and they discovered what they were doing wrong. And one of the elements of the constitution that Nehemiah had created was a statement against intermarriage. So maybe this all is just a throwback to that conversation back in chapter 8. And that was the Dat Mikra's idea. Another thought is these events just happen in sequence, and this is after they finish the wall and before what comes next in chapter 13. But again, Malbim says, no, that's not what's going on. Let's read what happens in sentences 4 to 9, because it makes a lot of sense. V'lifnei mizeh, before this, and again, your question has to be, before what, right? Before this. So either, the classic way that commentators read it, before what's coming next within this chapter, where there's going to be discussion about intermarriage below. However, Malbim is going to say, before what we just read. before they read from the Torah and they found that Ammon and Moab are not supposed to marry in, what happened? El Yashiva Kohen Nasun Bulishkas Beis Elokeinu Karov Latovia. El Yashiv the Kohen. He's not just a Kohen. He's El Yashiv the Kohen Gadol. El Yashiv the Kohen Gadol is located in the Lishka, the rooms of the house of God. In other words, he has an office in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash. Karov Litovia. Now the word Karov is an important word. What does Karov mean?
Near.
Near, like proximity, or? Or relative. Both of these are potential readings here. Rashi reads it as relative. He's a relative of Tovia. That makes a lot of sense. First of all, who was Tovia, remember? Close. Ammonite. He's a very bad man. Tovia is Tovia Sanballat, right? That group that opposed Nehemiah. Tovia is the one who has all the people saying nice things about him to Nehemiah. Tovia is potentially one of those who attempt to assassinate Nehemiah, or at least lure him out of the city in that story that we read several chapters ago, right? Tovia is a bad man. Well, now we find out, we're going to see, he's related to all sorts of people. Yashiv is related to Sanballat. We're going to find that out later this chapter. Sanballat was sort of the lead figure among the opposition when Nehemiah first arrived. And now it seems, and this is the way Rashi reads it, that Eliashiv the Kohen Gadol is also related to Tovia. So Eliashiv has a room there in the temple because he's the Kohen Gadol. He's the high priest. He has the high priest's office. Sorry?
Strange name.
Why?
Tovia? Is that guy?
His parents don't know that. So they named him Tovia. What do they know? So Tovia has this relative, El Yashiv, there in the temple, and what does he do? Vayas lo lishka gedola. El Yashiv makes for Tovia a great big office. Visham hayulefanim nosnim, and there before this they used to put et hamincha, the flower offerings, halavona, the frankincense, vakelim, utensils, umasara dagana tirosh vahayitzar, the tithes of grain, wine, and oil, mitzvat halaviyim, that which had been commanded to give to the Levites, used to go into this office, vahamishowarim, and the singers, vahashowarim, as well as for the people who are the gatekeepers, they're also subset of the Levi, utrumata kohanim, as well as the gifts for the kohanim. All of the property of the temple used to go into this great big storage space. Now it's been converted into Tovia's office. Well, how did that happen? Sentence 6. Uvachol zeh lo hayisi b'Yerushalayim, because I was out of town, Nehemiah says. I wasn't there in Jerusalem. Ki b'shnas shloshim u'shtayim v'artachshasta melech bavel basi el hamelech, because 12 years after I had arrived, had been the 20th year originally of Artaxasta. In year 32 of Artaxasta, Basi El HaMelech, I went back to the king. Notice he was called King of Babel. We talked about this ages ago in Ezra, about the blending of kingdom names. Because Persia conquers Babylon, he becomes King of Babylon as well as King of Persia. Don't get hung up on it. He is the Persian Empire. But the Nehemiah says, I wasn't in town. I went back to Persia. Ulekeitz yamim, and then after some period of time, and we don't know how long that was, nishalti min hamelech, I again was able to get away from the king and to say, can I please go back to Judea? I need to take care of things there. And so I came back, va'avol Yerushalayim, and I came to Jerusalem, va'avina va'ra'ah sherasah el Yashiv l'Tovia, and I understood this terrible thing that El Yashiv had done on behalf of Tovia, la'asos lo nishka v'chatzrei beis ha'elokim, giving him an office in the temple. You follow what's happening now? The way to read this story is the following. And we're not done yet. We have a couple of more sentences. But the way to read this story is Nehemiah went back to Persia. He was always here for a limited period of time. He was assigned to come here and take care of the walls. He took care of the walls. He went back home. He comes back to Judea. And he finds, lo and behold, Tovia is now a resident of the temple. He's got a nice big office. And of all places, the place where they stored the gifts for the tribe of Levi. And Nehemiah had been the one to work so hard to make sure that those gifts would be brought there. Right? We had said that that was a major sticking point for Nehemiah. He wanted to make sure at the end of chapter 12 that Levi would stay around the temple and do their job. And so he said, I'm going to make sure that they can do that. They're financially secure because I'm going to have all the tithes brought to them. So now he comes back and he says, uh-oh. That's a problem. So what does he do? Susan, I saw your hand. I'm just going to finish this section first. So what do? I arrange for a big public reading. And in that reading from the Torah, we don't read random passages, stories of the Jews getting out of Egypt or Abraham and Sarah or something. No, no, no. We read the passage which says, Ammon doesn't get to marry into the Jewish people in order to rally the people against Tobiah. And so what does he do? This is great. Sentence 8. Vayera li ma'od. Boy, was I angry. Va'ashlicha es kol klei veis Tobiah ha'chutz min ha'lishka. I took all his stuff. And I personally, it sounds like, right? I personally grabbed it and threw it out. Va'omra. And I issued an order. Vayetaharu ha'lishachos. And they purified the offices. Right? Purified. Not in the sense that there was something, you know, there was a dead rat there in the office and they took it out. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is they purified it from Tobiah, is the point. He had contaminated it by dint of his presence. So I had them clean everything out. Va'ashiv Hashem klei beis ha'elokim, and I put in there once again the vessels of the house of God, es ha'mincha v'halavona, the flour offering, the frankincense, not the tithes, because those have to be restored still. But I put in there what was supposed to be there. Susan.
But what is Why did Ezra allow it to happen? Wasn't he supposed to be there as well by now?
Good question. What are the answers? You can offer at least two answers, right? Either Ezra doesn't play this kind of a role. Remember that when Ezra found out about intermarriage, he tore his hair, he sat on the ground, he cried. But it was the people who said, we have to do something about this. Ezra is not someone who's going to grab the guy's stuff and throw it out by force. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that Ezra's dead by now. He was mentioned in the previous chapter, but we don't find when he dies. We don't know. It's entirely possible that in this interim period, which we don't know how long it runs, right, while Nehemiah is back home, right, it's entirely possible that Ezra passes away and only after that does Tobiah get installed. We don't know.
When we learned Ezra, he did have command. He did seem to be able to lead the people.
He was,
and suddenly with Nehemiah, he's lost the ability to be a leader.
He was empowered to. The king gave him the authority.
Right, but he didn't.
But he didn't. That's the key. Ezra is an inspirer. He's a motivator. But he's not the one to carry out the jobs over and over again. Meaning, when Ezra wants to get the people together to go to Judea, he says, hey, there are no Levium. What's up with that? And he calls somebody and he says, or somebody's, and says, help, let's rustle up some Levium. And they go off and they get Levium.
So he's a good delegator, but not a good delegator.
Not so much that he's a good delegator, because I think that diminishes what he does. He inspires people. He gives them direction. And he will create law. We find Ezra create law. He's the sofer. He's the expert. But if you want someone who's going to bodily pick up Tobiah and throw him out of the temple, Nehemiah is your man. I think that's really what we see in terms of the bifurcation of roles between Ezra and Nehemiah. It's hard, but I think that's the way to read it. To take a look quickly at source number one, where I brought you the Malbim's read. And in the interest of time, I'm just reading the English, but you can see the original as well. The text here explained why they read from Mishneh Torah that day, the book of Devarim, the record about Ammon. Because Eliashiv the Kohen had his office close to the office of Tobiah. The Malbim reads the word karov, not as relative, but as proximity. For he had made for Tobiah a great office beside his office. And there in that office they had given the gifts, etc. And at that time they no longer gave the tithes. And the office was empty. And the Kohen let Tobiah reside there. So the public reading is going to happen in order to make sure that people understand what you've just done is not allowed, and so he continues in number two, and because the relatives of Toviah and the nobles challenged Nehemiah on this, he commanded to read from the Torah and to show them that Toviah was prohibited from marrying into the community. He wants to show this shall not pass. So that's the way to read the story. Elisheva.
I'm just wondering, just in terms of maybe the connection with Yehuda Esther, is I wonder if it's coincidence not being coincidence. So it's not such coincidence that he happened to read this. It's not such coincidence that he happened to be reading the scroll.
Right. So maybe it connotes not only divinely arranged, but also the fact that it looks coincidental when it's not. Right. Could be. Could well be. I think Moshe's point is really well taken. I think it's a fascinating idea. I'm not sure what to do with it, but I agree with you. The idea that it's not just coincidence is common to both stories. Less so if you read it as Malbim does, that it's really not coincidence, because that's actually what Nehemiah was doing with this public reading. The only problem with Malbim's read is that the sentences are out of order. You really should have said, I was away, I came back, I found him there, and I had them read from this, and then I threw him out. But maybe it's because this is the way he did it. In other words, maybe he didn't tell people what he was doing. He held a big public reading, said, oh, would you look at that? I guess this fellow has a problem. Let's help him on his way. You know, something along those lines.
But it does say, it could have happened.
Yes, it entirely possible. The only question is, what is Zed? Right, the question is really, what is Zed? Yeah. Now, one side note within this conversation. When you put Tovia in this room in the temple, what happens with the tithes? So one way to look at it, the way that I would have read it probably, and Sharon says it, is they're just not collecting them anymore. They're not doing that anymore. And that's Malbim's way to read it. That's Mitzudat David. Sorry, Mitzudat David reads it that way. It's just his office now. However, Ibn Ezra seems to say that it's even worse. Take a look at Ibn Ezra, number three. He says, Eliyashiv was the one who made this office for Toviah. And in Toviah's office, they would place the items mentioned. You could read that as they used to place the items mentioned before he took over, but you could just as easily read that as, no, now they're still doing this. Like, Toviah is now receiving all the tithes that had gone into this office in the first place. That makes this even more sinister. Yes. Correct. No, Malbim's read is like Mitzvah David, that Mitzvah David does. That it's just the office and not that he's getting the tithes. Right? Now, if you're Toviah, why do you want this space? I think this is a key point. If you're Toviah, why do you want a room in the temple? You're not a fan of the temple. Remember, you opposed the whole thing. Why do you want a room in the temple?
Next to the Kohen Gadol, and you're going to be... have authority.
Right. So one way to look at it, I mean, the simplest way to look at it is if you take Ibn Ezra's view, that he really is getting the tithes. Right? He may not like the bank, but it's where the money is. The second approach would be, as Joseph says, maybe it gives him legitimacy in the Jewish community. Right? He has an office there in the temple. But I would add something. One of the points that we made at length when they constructed the temple and when they had such funding from the Persian government was that this became a Persian government building. Right? With all the protections. We said those who work there are exempt from the king's taxes and so on, right? So it could be that it isn't so much a matter of having status within the Jewish community, but it gives them standing with the Persians. You know, now he has an office in the Persian government building that is the capital of Judea. I wonder if that isn't part of his desire to be in the space, is the bigger pulpit, so to speak, that this now gives him. Just a thought. So I mentioned last week that we don't actually know Nehemiah's time frame for how long he's gone. No one even comments on it among the traditional commentators. The most you get is Malbim in number four, who says, for the king had summoned him, commanding him to remain with him for a term, and after the term ended, I was asked from the king's meaning I requested his permission to return. That's it. There was a period of time when he's back in Persia, The king wants him back for some duration, we don't know what, and then he gets to go back to Judea, and really that's all the information we get. No one really talks about this. So, summary of two possible reads of the beginning of this chapter. Either this is a sequence of events after the wall was completed. Right? This is Mitzvah David. The wall was completed. They did this reading. They found out this thing about Amon and Moab. Nehemiah left. Nehemiah came back. Kicked out Tobiah. Simple and straightforward. Not a lot of coherence to it, but that's the narrative. Or the reading that Dat Mikra attributes to Kuzari, which, again, as I said last week, I'm not so convinced about. But the Dat Mikra says, back in the day, they read from the Torah and they separated the intermarriages way back in chapter 8. Now, Nehemiah found Tobiah in the temple and he kicked him out. Also, to me, not so compelling. Or the reading of Malvin, who says Nehemiah comes back to Judea, finds Tobiah in the temple, rallies the people by reading aloud the prohibition on Ammon and Moab, and so he is able to evict Tobiah. The upshot of all of this, though, which sets the stage for the rest of the chapter and therefore the book, is that the fight between Nehemiah and the local opposition is ongoing. And the temple is in the middle of it. Right? Meaning, I might have thought the war is over. Nehemiah won. He dedicated the wall that he came for in the first place, the one everybody was trying to prevent him from building. The Jews have now returned. He has this great big shiny new constitution. I would have thought, it's all over. We're good. End Tanakh now before you get into trouble. But we start chapter 13 and we find out that actually, not so much. The temple itself is inhabited by Tobiah. The opposition is right there at home. The tithes have stopped. Your constitution is in trouble. It's all actually very much up in the air in terms of how long Nehemiah's achievements are going to last. Clear? That's where we are at this stage.
There's also been intermarriage. I mean, that's
shocking. Yep, and it only gets worse. It gets worse, not better. So let's take a look. Chapter 13, sentences 10 to 13. What we're going to find, I'll give you the preface now, it'll help with the structure. What we're now going to find is that everything about Nehemiah's constitution has just been dynamited. He had three major platforms. We noted seven different aspects to the Constitution, but you could really group them, for the most part, under three headings, right? One heading was the tithes, right? Making sure the tithes would be collected in Jerusalem and everybody would give the first fruits and all of that. That was one. Number two, Shabbos, right? Making sure to protect Shabbat. And number three, intermarriages. Ending the intermarriages. Those are your basic three themes for the Constitution, and you're going to find out that all three of them have now been blown to bits. Nehemiah's not happy, but he doesn't give up. Nehemiah never gives up. So let's see what happens. Sentences 10 to 13 are about the tithes. Va'eda'ah. I found out. Kimnayos ha'leviyim lo nitana. The portions for the Leviyim had not been given. And the Leviim, the singers, the people doing the work, they had all fled to their fields. So I picked on the deputies, right? All those people I left in charge. I said to them, why is the house of our God abandoned? I said specifically, we'll not abandon it, right? But that didn't work. Apparently it is abandoned. Vo'ek b'tzeim. So I brought them back, and it sounds like he puts them on his back. He went out gathering Leviim. Va'amidei malomdam. And I put them at their posts. Again, v'chol Yehuda heviu ma'asar hadagan v'atirosh v'yitzhar la'otzaros. And again, all of Judea brought the tithes to the storehouses. And I put in charge of these storehouses Shalemya HaKohen B'tzadok HaSofer Ufadaya Min HaLeviyim. I put these three people in charge of the stores, and the three people we mentioned here, Baal Yadam Hanan Ben Zakur Ben Matanya, and with them this fellow Hanan They were trusted by everybody, and they would then distribute everything to their brothers. So I created a new structure once again to take care of this. And each time Nehemiah repairs something from his constitution, he does what amuses Devi so much. Zachroli Elokai al Zos. He says, God, remember me for this. Let my acts of kindness, my acts of generosity that I did for the house of my God and for its ships, let that never be erased. Okay. We have a few things to talk about here. First of all, and I would like to leave it for everybody to ask questions and so on, but in the interest of time, that's just not happening. There's an odd word in sentence 10. The verb, vayivrechu, ish lesadehu. What does vayivrach mean?
Flee.
To flee. Is that a term for running to or running from?
From?
Running from, right? But that's not what they're doing. They're running to, right? If you take a look on your sheet, you see what I brought you here. Where do they go? Source number 5, Rashi says, they fled and left, hither and yon. Or as the Hebrew goes, ana va'ana. I always wanted a chance to use hither and yon on a sheet. They fled and left, hither and yon, to seek their gifts. They were not as involved in their tasks, right? They left to the fields, not to their own fields, but to everybody else's fields. Or Mitzudat Davidin, number 6. Each one fled to his field to work it. They got themselves jobs. Each clan of Kohanim lived in a particular city, and there was land there. The cities of the Levium had fields as well. So they did. They didn't have a tribal portion, but there were cities that they had. And also, frankly, since the beginning of the Second Temple, for all we know, they bought land off of people anyway. But they went to fields and they worked it themselves. They plowed, they harvested, they became farmers. So what do you mean when you say fled, which sounds like it's about leaving the temple, as opposed to that they went to their fields or went to the fields of others in order to collect? So here I think we see another important theme, which is the emphasis is not on them going to work or going to collect. The emphasis is the abandonment of the temple. That's what Nehemiah is exercised about. Nehemiah is angry because the temple is being ignored. He's made that point before. What has him upset is that the Beit HaMikdash, his temple, is abandoned. And so he chooses the verb that talks about the abandonment, not about how they went and made a living now. That's one point. The other point that I want to note for you here is that he insists on picking people who are ne'eman, who are credible to the community. I gave you a reference on the sheet to number 7, just because I like the source, which talks about the importance of appointing collectors of tzedakah who are known, credible people. And the question of whether they have to give a public accounting or whether they should only voluntarily give a public accounting. But it's really important to make sure that that the community has people who they will trust to oversee the communal fund. And that's what he's going after here. And then he congratulates himself. Why does Nehemiah need to congratulate himself? What's that about? So we've seen this before, right? We saw it before in chapter 5 when he took care of all of the when he took care of all of the loans, right? People were broke and they were indentured and they had sold themselves, they had sold all their land in order to pay off their debts, and they came to Nehemiah, and Nehemiah said, okay, all debts are abolished, right? That was Nehemiah's solution to the problem, and he said, God, remember me for the good, look what I did. So, at the time, we noted that he's criticized, because he says, not only did I abolish the debts, but I also didn't take any money. I didn't take any public funds. I had to entertain diplomats from elsewhere and hold these big feasts and support everybody. I did it out of my own money. I did not collect the way that all the other leaders before me did. And the Gemara understood that as a criticism, not only of Persian leaders or Babylonian leaders, but a criticism of Jewish leaders. And it said, that's why he loses his name on the book. Why originally, it's all called the Book of Ezra. It's only much later in history that this becomes known as the Book of Nehemiah, precisely to criticize him for self-congratulation. In other words, the Talmud views it as a character flaw, that he needs to do this. Yeah? Yeah?
Could we say that he's a consummate politician?
And he needs to put it in the book, just in case, you know, there's a campaign coming.
Sides against the middle.
Who do we know who's not taking any money for doing a big job?
Well, yeah.
The name of the Savior, right? Trump. And congratulations himself.
He's taking money also, but that's a side point. But I think there are other ways to read this. Malvin read it back in chapter 5 as a prayer on behalf of the nation. He appeals to God to help the nation in the, you know, in the merit of his actions. But that fits chapter 5. It doesn't really fit over here. It's hard to fit into the text here until you get to the last of them where he's going to mention the nation again. But generally it's not. The second approach we brought, I listed this for you in number 8, so you'd have it on the sheet. Encyclopedia Mikra'id made a point, which I think is very worth noting, because it fits. And that is, Nehemiah has detractors. He has people who hate him. He has people who want to tear him down. He has people who want to make him look illegitimate in the eyes of the nation. So maybe it's important that he do this, in order to say, look, here's my record. Don't let them make me look bad. Don't let them make me look like I'm doing this for myself. Don't let them make me look like a pawn of the Persian government. Here's my record, you judge. And I think that's a cogent way to read what's going on. But I think there's also a third element which fits here, which didn't fit in chapter 5, but I think it's relevant here, which is, since what we're talking about is the demolition of his constitution, right? That's what this is about. The three major planks in his platform are being taken apart by the opposition. What he's saying here is, I didn't give in. I came back, and I fought all over again, and we reinstated it. And so each time he reinstates an element of that constitution, he says, see that? They didn't win. We were able to get the last word. Which you do when you write the book. I think that's what he's doing. I think he's trying to get the last word against the enemies who had taken apart the breach that he had created. So he congratulates himself for that. Those are the tithes. Then we move on to Shabbos. Sentences 15 to 22. Tedvav to Chafbet. We are now on page 1871. Bayamim Ahema. Back in those days, right? Again, we get Bayamim Ahema. Right? They again locating this in time. Tedvav, sentence 15. Reisi v'Yehuda dorchim gitos b'Shabbos. I saw in Judea that they were trampling the grapes on Shabbos. They were crushing the grapes to make wine. They're doing it on Shabbos. For reference, yes, that is prohibited. It is biblically prohibited. It comes under the prohibition of schita / dosh, which is threshing. You're not allowed to thresh on Shabbos, and that includes crushing the fruit in order to get the juice out. The reason I stress it is because the Zakheim book does something that's just, I don't know what he thought he was doing when he said that this was rabbinic. And he quotes you a source, but the source doesn't say it's rabbinic. The source says it's biblical. I don't know. He quotes you two sources. One isn't about this, and the other one says it's biblical. So it's a biblical prohibition. Umviim ha'arimos, and they were also bringing piles of grain. Va'omsim al hachamorim, and they were loading them on the donkeys. Ve'af yayin anavim uteinim, as well as the wine. I assume this is wine from grapes and figs, as opposed to wine from grapes and figs. But I don't actually know, because you can ferment figs, perhaps. I don't know. How do they translate it? Do they distinguish? No, they do it as wine, grapes, and figs. So okay, so then it does, that solves your problem. Yayin, comma, anavim, comma, uteinim, the Oxford comma. Okay, the chomasah, every burden. Umiviim Yerushalayim beyom haShabbos. They're bringing it to Jerusalem on Shabbos, and these are Jews. This is not foreigners. Va'aid biyom mimichram tzayid. Va'aid, and I warned them. I made a public declaration. What you're doing is wrong, right? That's the way they should translate it over here. Yeah, I warned them. On the day that they sold these goods for people, and it's not just the Jews, it's also the merchants from the nations. Vahat Tsorim, Ted Zayin, sentence 16. Tsorim are the people of Tsor, Tyre, T-Y-R-E, up north. They are known in Tanakh as sea merchants. Right? They're Phoenicians. The Tsor and Sidon I don't know if they're Phoenicians by Nehemiah's day, but at one point in history, the Phoenician ships. But there's sea merchants throughout Tanakh. Yeshaya has a passage somewhere around chapter 22, 21, 22, 23, where he blasts them and says down their downfall is coming. There are some issues with us at various times in Tanakh. You look in Yechezkel, he talks about them. But in any case, here their role simply is. They're merchants. So Vatsarim Yashvuva, they dwelled there. They sat there with their goods in Yerushalayim. Mivim Dug, they brought fish. I think it's Ibn Ezra who says, don't worry about the Aleph in Dug. It's still fish. V'chol Mecher, and all sorts of goods to sell. They brought merchandise. Umachrim b'Shabbos Livnei Yehuda ubi Yerushalayim. And they're selling it on Shabbos to the Judeans and in Yerushalayim. Who was it who made the point? Let me see if I can find it in my notes quickly. Mitzudat David says, he repeated Jerusalem unnecessarily here. You know it's Jerusalem already. Your point is that they're selling it to Bnei Yehuda, to the Judeans. So Mitzudat David says, yeah, but your point is it's the holy city. They're selling it to Judeans and in Yerushalayim of all places. How can that be? How can they be getting away with this? Malbin points out three levels of activity here. Number one, the biblical prohibition against threshing. Number two, there's a biblical law that requires that you let your animals rest, and they're bringing it on their animals. That was stressed here. And it's the prohibition against doing business, which is a rabbinic prohibition, lest you write things down, which presumably you do when you do business. You need to write receipts. So he's horrified that this is going on. So what does he do? Va'ariva, sentence 17. Va'ariva eis chorei Yehuda. I fought with the leaders of Judea. Va'omra lahem. And I said to them, Ma davar harazeh asher atem osim? What is this terrible thing you're doing? U'mechalim es yom haShabbos. You're desecrating the Sabbath day. Halocha asu avoseichem. Don't you remember? That's what your ancestors did. Va'yavei Elokeinu aleinu eis kol ha'ra'ah hazos. And God brought terrible things upon us. He's referring here to the time of Yeshaya, when Yeshaya warned about violation of Shabbos. I think Yirmiyahu as well has warnings about it. So that's how we ended up in trouble, because we didn't listen to the laws, because we desecrated Shabbos. Ve'alir azos, on this very city as well. Ve'atem mosifim charon al Yisrael. Now you're going to increase God's anger against Israel, achalas haShabbos, by desecrating Shabbos all over again. He says, this shall not be. Now I also understand another reason why he would emphasize Yerushalayim. They're doing it in Yerushalayim, because he says you're going to bring anger on this city specifically. So I think that adds to the point that Mitzudat David was trying to make about him using that name, specifying Yerushalayim. Okay, so he says, I fought with the leaders of Judea. I want to come back to that in a couple of minutes. But first, let's finish the story. Because Nehemiah here, once again, gets to show us why he's Nehemiah and almost nobody else in Tanakh is. Watch what he does. Vayihi kasher tzalalu sharei Yerushalayim lefnei haShabbos. It's Friday afternoon. Sun is getting low. The gates of Yerushalayim are casting shadows already. It's that late. Salalu, right? Like Tzilalei Erev. Va'omra, and I gave the order. Va'yisagru hadalasos, and the gates of the city were closed. Va'omra, and I declared, Asher lo yiftachum ad achar haShabbos. I said, don't you open this until Shabbos is over. Umino arai ha'emadati al hasha'arim, and I assigned my youths to go stand by the gates. Lo yavo masavi yom haShabbos. Nothing gets into this city on Shabbos. Well, so what do they do? Vayalino haRochlim mochrei komim karmichutz Yerushalayim pa'amushtayim. So what happens? The first Shabbos, the peddlers all wait outside, figuring either. One commentator says, figuring people will open the gates for them. Another commentator says, figuring that people will leave the city in order to buy from them outside. But they figure, let's try it. They wait the first Shabbos, nothing doing. They wait the second Shabbos, nothing doing. Va'ida bahem. So I went out, and I yelled at them. Va'omra lehem, and I said to them, Madua atem leinim neged hachoma. Why are you staying here by the wall? Im tishnu, if you do it again, yad eshlach bachem. I'm going to send my hand against you. Menaisa hilo va'o b'Shabbos. And they stop coming on Shabbos. And I warned the Levim, I said to them, Asher yiyu mitaharim uva'im shomrim hasharim l'kadesh es yom haShabbos, that they should purify themselves and come guard the gates to sanctify the day of Shabbos. So I appointed guards from Levi. Gamzo zachrali elokai v'chuso alai kerov chasdecha. And his second statement, second platform reinstated, God remember this for me for the good. That's his reinstatement of Shabbos. You can't get anything past them. He knows all the tricks. But a few key notes here. First of all, very important point from the history of halacha standpoint. There is a Mishnah in Shabbos, in source number 9, I brought you the Gemara on it, which talks about the laws of muktzah. The laws of muktzah are generally assumed to be rabbinic laws. Muktzah, by definition, either means items that were set aside before Shabbos, I'm not going to use these on Shabbos, or items that I did not plan to use on Shabbos. There's a debate about how to characterize muktzah. Is it items that I planned not to use, which is a very narrow field, or is it items that I didn't plan to use, which makes it a much broader field? But that's what muktzah refers to, and then there are all sorts of categories within that. So items that I'm normally used for prohibited purposes, right, would be an example of that. I didn't plan to use that on Shabbos. I'm not allowed to use it on Shabbos. Items that are very, very expensive and fragile, and therefore I don't handle them normally. I don't move them. So again, I don't plan to use those on Shabbos. So there's a rabbinic rule. Again, almost everyone believes that it's rabbinic. That says, don't handle these on Shabbos. They're off limits. When did this enactment come into place? Says the Talmud, Nehemiah did it. And that originally the reason for doing it was because he warned they're transporting things on Shabbos. The best way to get people not to be able to transport these goods is if you say, don't handle them, not don't touch them, you're allowed to touch a muktzah item. You're not allowed to move a muktzah item. Touching a muktzah item, you can do all day long if, you know, it makes you feel good. It's moving it that's actually the issue, lest you transport it on Shabbos. Take a look at source number 9. This is the Gemara at the bottom, the Hebrew is the bottom of one side, the English is the top of the next side. The Mishnah had said, at first, there was a series of rules. First, it was very strict, and then it was rolled back little by little. At first, they said only 3 implements could be moved on Shabbos. They said only 3 utensils you're allowed to move. And 2 kinds of knives and a spoon. That's it. They then permitted more, and then they rolled it back over time as people's conduct improved. So Rabbi Chanina said, in the days of Nehemiah, son of Hakalia, this Mishnah, it's actually not a Mishnah, it's a Braita, it's contemporary with the Mishnah, was taught, and he quotes our verse. So they understand Muktzah to be Nehemiah's enactment in order to prevent people from bringing the merchandise on Shabbos. That's one piece that I thought is worth knowing. You can't really learn Nehemiah chapter 13 without knowing that. That's number one. Number two, Nehemiah in sentence 17 picked on the leaders. Right? That's very characteristic of not only Nehemiah, but Ezra as well. The responsibility of the leaders. They're the ones who we're going to look to and say, either shape up or give the job to somebody else. Right? When Levi didn't show up to make Aliyah, so Ezra, through others, acted against them. When the leaders had intermarried, right? That was what Ezra found out in chapter 9 in Ezra. The leaders had intermarried. So Ezra rallies against the leadership. The wealthy people with their loans in Nehemiah chapter 5. So Nehemiah acted against the leadership. It's a sense that the leaders are the ones who are responsible, and don't give them a pass. Don't say they're too big to fail or they're too big for me to take them on. Go after them. And so that's what Nehemiah does. He doesn't bother the rank and file people. He goes after the leadership. And then third, last point on this, and then I'll take the question, is, did you notice who he put in charge here? Who does he put in charge of the gates? Right, Susan said? The Levium. The Levium. Why the Levium in particular? Why put Levi in charge of the gates on Shabbos? Keep them in town.
Didn't they earlier associate them with the walls when they were building?
There were some Levium among the builders, but there were also non-Levium built. So Ralbach has a very practical religious point. He says, in truth, in number 10, in truth, he commanded this because Shabbos was not recognizable in the temple, for the Kohen performed their tasks on Shabbos. Right? There are all sorts of things that you do as part of the daily service in the temple. You bring a karban, you do shchita, you put parts on the fire on the altar. The answer is that the God who told you don't do this told you do this, so you do it. But this way, they have a Shabbos also. You put them out by the gates, and you have them be the ones to guard it. That's Ralbag. But I think you could also suggest here, this goes back to a point we made earlier, that the Levim have a broader educational role in the community. It isn't only about the temple service. The Kohanim and Levim also have an educational function. They have a judicial function. And so maybe that's why he puts them on the gates. Someone comes to the gates and says, I want to sell something, I want to buy something. The Levim, that's your job. You go out and explain to him, we're closed for business today, is our Sabbath. You know, that to me is a reasonable explanation for what he's doing here. Susan, you were going to ask something.
Isn't his power from Persia? Because, I mean, this
yes.
is a big change that's making them all listen.
Yep.
Because they're afraid of what they'll do if he does. I'm like, what?
Yes, he is backed by Persia, you bet. That was very clear, and so that the opposition didn't initially dare to attack him directly, and they tried all the different kinds of subterfuge to weaken the people's spirit and to undermine them psychologically and to lure him out of the city because they were afraid to take him on directly. That's correct. Okay, we're in the home stretch. Sentence 23. The third plank, intermarriage. Gam bayim imahem, also in those days. We're at sentence 23, still page 1871. Ra'isi es ha-Yehudim hoshivu nashim ashdodiyot, ammoniyot, moaviyot. I saw that the people of Judea had taken wives who were from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Now, again, it's unlikely that, like we said with Tovia being from Ammon, we said that these nations have all been scrambled. To actually think that these are bona fide, you know, Ammon, Moab, and Ashdod is div. Ashdod means from the Plishtim. Let's start with that. The Plishtim, the Philistines, had five cities in the area that is today Aza, right? You had Aza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Ekron, and Gat. That was five? Yes. So those are the five main Philistine cities historically. And when he says they're marrying Ashdodiyot, he means they're marrying Philistines, is what he's talking about. There is a debate as to whether you had maybe, I think it was Malbim who suggested that there may be some people around still, yeah, with Malbim, who suggested maybe there were still some people from Ammon and Moab who identified that way. Could be, but doesn't have to be. The bottom line is, they ain't Jewish. And they're married to Jews. And not only that, look what he says in number 24. He says, Uvnehem, their kids, Chatsim edaber ashdodit, half of them speak Philistine. They can't speak Jewish, which means Hebrew, just for the record. No. They speak all these different languages. Most take this to mean that half of them or some percentage of them speak Ashdodit. However, Malbim actually says they spoke Yiddish. Not literally. Malbim says that what he means is they not half of them spoke Ashdodit. They spoke half Ashdodit, half Hebrew. Much as Yiddish and Ladino are blends of Hebrew with other languages, so they're speaking a language that's half Hebrew, half Ashdodit. That's the other way to
say it. They kicked out all the women, right? They kicked out all the Gentile women before. So now we're talking about Jewish men going back out into the fields and finding good wives.
Sure. Ostensibly, good wives. Yes.
So
ostensibly, yes. So, Va'arivi Mom. So what did I do? Well, my name is Nehemiah. Va'arivi Mom, I fought with them. Va'akalaleim, and I cursed them. Va'akem mehem, we'll come back to that, don't worry. Va'akem mehem, and I hit them, Anoshim. Only the males. No, I assume that means I struck them with men, like I hired people to do it. Va'em retain, and I pulled out their hair. Va'ashbi'em belokin, and not only that, I made them swear by God, im titnu v'nosechem livnehem, that you will not give your daughters to the men from the nations, v'im tisumi v'nosechem livnehem v'lochem, and you will not marry their daughters, and you will not let your sons marry their daughters. I said, no way, no how. We're going to come back to that, to his actions. I just want to get the sentences done. Hallo al eilech ata Shlomo melech Yisrael. He says, Shlomo, king of Israel, sinned with this. Boy, that came out of left field. Uvagoyim harabim lo haya melech kamohu. You want to know how great he was? There wasn't a king like him anywhere in the world. Ve'ahuv lelo kavaya. He was beloved to his God. Vayimneyu elokim melech al kol Yisrael. God made him king over all Israel. Gam osom hechtiyu anashim hanachriyos. And when he married foreign women, they made him sin. Where did that come from? We're going to come back to it. You think you're getting away with this? to do this. How can you think you can do this terrible thing, trespassing against God? Lo shimna shimna chriyos, to set up these foreign wives. Earlier, when we talked about it as an offense against the Jewish women. Now he's focused on the offense against God. I think it was Ezra who really focused more on it also being an offense to the Jewish women. Umibnei Yoyada ben El Yashiv HaKohen HaGadol Chatan L'Sanbalat HaChoroni. Among the sons or descendants of El Yashiv the Kohen Gadol was somebody who was a son-in-law to Sanbalat, who was the head of the opposition when Nehemiah first showed up. Va'avricheyu me'alai, I kicked him out. And then, as required, Zachra lahem elokai, al ga'alea kihuna uvrisa kihuna ba'halaviyim. Remember them, God, those kicked out of the kihuna, the brit of kihuna, and the leviim. This sentence is a little bit hard to render. It's generally assumed that what he's saying here is that, remember for the good, the fact that we kicked them out. That's the way Ibn Ezra takes it, that's the way Rashi takes it. Mitzvah David says, no, remember the people we kicked out and punish them. It's a negative against them. That's the JPS also. Vitziartim mikol ben nechar. He says, I purified them from all mikol nechar, from all foreigners. Va'amida mishmaros lekohanim v'alavim ish b'mlachto. And I set up the shifts of the kohanim and levim to work in the temple. Ula korban ha'itzim, and the wood that they would bring as a gift to the temple, be'itim mizumanos at set times. V'la bikurim, and the first fruits. Zachra li elokai letova. God, remember it for me for the best. Okay, we have a lot to see on these last sentences. Let's see what we can do. First of all, his violent response. What is the precedent for cursing people? What in the world does that even look like? So, even at, sorry?
And beating them.
And beating them. But what is he cursing them with? What does it even mean? See, Ibn Ezra says that it's a cheirem ban. It's an excommunication. Issuing a curse is saying God should cut them off from the nation. And he has them swear not to engage in these marriages. And it seems very harsh. But here I quote you for one last time the Zakheim book in number 11. And again, there's so much that I've seen in this book that I'm not a fan of, but I like what he does here. He says, more than any other statement in Nehemiah's memoir, this one has been cited to indicate that he was an unrelenting extremist, what is now termed a religious fundamentalist. Given the stakes and the times he lived in, Nehemiah was nothing of the sort. His objective was essentially to humiliate the men who had married foreign wives, so as to root out intermarriage once and for all. Intermarriage was not only a religious threat to the community, it was a political threat that could undermine the congregation's cohesion. Another ruler, even one who was not a despot, might for these reasons have executed some of the offenders as an example to the rest. Nehemiah did nothing of the sort. Although he began with censure and progressively moved to more violent and humiliating forms of punishment, Nehemiah stopped short of capital punishment. His objective was not the death of the offenders, but rather their adherence to their vow to forswear intermarriage in the future. So he says, look, he didn't kill him. That's got to count for something. But given the way Nehemiah perceives this as a threat to the future of the Jewish people, that's why he is so strong in his response. Then after this, Nehemiah invokes Shlomo. And now Shlomo was led astray. I'm actually really bothered by this passage, and I don't have an answer for this. I'm just going to state the question, and if there's time at the end, then we can come back to it. He doesn't talk about the evil of the intermarriage itself. He says, these foreign women led Shlomo astray. How could you think you won't be led astray when you marry them? It's almost as though the marriage itself was fine. But don't you know what this is going to do? You follow? If you remember way, way back, a year ago, in the end of Ezra, we debated the question of whether intermarriage beyond the seven Canaanite nations was biblically prohibited or rabbinically prohibited. This would support the view that the intermarriage itself is a rabbinic prohibition, and what he's saying is there's a reason why it's prohibited, because it's going to lead you astray, the same way that Shlomo, Solomon was led astray when he married these women. We find that he allows them to build altars for idolatry. Worse, if you read the literal read of the text, it sounds like Shlomo himself is building the altars for idolatry. So maybe that's what he's that's why he says it. In other words, maybe what he's saying is, even if this is taken as a rabbinic prohibition, which is difficult, I didn't like that view initially, and I still don't. I think it's hard to sustain, especially because here we include Ammon and Moab, which are for sure biblical. But he says, don't you know where this is going to lead you? And it's going to lead our nation. Regarding Shlomo, it's very important to recognize that historically, our commentaries, including the ones that are not inclined towards hagiography, the ones who are the literalists, did not understand that Shlomo actually married foreign women. Rather, Shlomo engaged in political marriages with pro forma conversions. And it amounts to, as far as we are concerned, foreign wives, because they never suspended their relationship with their foreign gods and their foreign cultures. I brought you one example from Maimonides in number 12. And again, reading quickly, he says, do not entertain the thought that Shimshon, he's commenting here first about Shimshon with the Philistine women. He says, do not entertain the thought that Shimshon, rescuer of Israel, or Solomon, king of Israel, who was called a, quote, friend of God, he's named Yedid Hashem, married foreign women when they were not Jewish. Rather, the secret of the matter is thus. The proper mitzvah is that when a ger or gioret comes to convert, right, male or female convert, we investigate him to see whether he is coming to join the religion to gain money or power or out of fear. If he is a man, we investigate whether he has turned his eyes to a Jewish woman. If she is a woman, we investigate whether she has turned her eyes to a Jewish man. If no cause is found, we inform them of the weight for the yoke of Torah and the strain for ignorant people in practicing it, so that they will separate from it. If they accept and do not separate, and we see that they pursue this from love, we accept them, as the Pasuk in Rus says, that Naomi accepted her. Therefore, the courts did not accept converts in the time of David and Solomon. In the days of David, lest they come from fear. In the days of Solomon, lest they pursue this for the empire, benefit, and power which Jews had. Because an idolater who pursues Judaism for one of the empty aspects of this world is not a righteous convert. Still, many converts converted in the days of David and Solomon, with regular people, meaning you didn't get a proper court. Three people got together, accepted the conversion, and move on. The high court was concerned for them, not rejecting them since they had still immersed, but not drawing them near until it could see their end. It said, you know, we're not sure how to view these conversions. And because Solomon converted women and married them, and Shimshon also converted and married, and it was known that the women pursued this only for benefit and were not converted by a true court, the text viewed them as idolaters remaining prohibited. Further, their end demonstrated their original intent, for they served their idols and built altars, and the text viewed it as though Solomon had built them, and he quotes the verse, then Solomon built an altar. So as far as Hamani is concerned, Shlomo didn't actually marry out, but he might as well have, because he married women with inappropriate conversions. So he invokes Shlomo. I want to come back to invoking Shlomo in a moment, because I think it's a good closing point for this. But before I do that, this business with chasing off the son of the Kohen Gadol, who's married to Sanballat's daughter, right? So there are two different approaches to why he chased him off. Mitzvah David brings both in number 13. He says either because this kid is defying the oath, he's remaining married to her, or because, as a son-in-law to Sanballat, Sanballat now has an excuse to be in the city. He's visiting family. So he says, if I kick him out, Sanballat has no entry into the city, and he can't come spy what's going on and try to undermine me. That's the argument. But I wanted to highlight, to finish, 2 points here. Number one, Nehemiah's emphasis on language. Right? He's angry about the intermarriages, and he says, they can't even speak Hebrew. Why is that a big deal?
Prayer. What is Zakheim says, okay?
Yeah.
About political threat.
Right.
It could undermine the community.
Right. It's about their cohesion as a community. If they can't speak Hebrew, they're going to identify as a different population. Right? That's the way it works. Right? I think people who came post-war who could speak Yiddish and who couldn't speak Yiddish. Yeah, you end up with different populations developing, different institutions, different shul schools and everything. That's the way it works. I just, in the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and mention one other thing. So I think that's an important point, it's the language point, but also the invocation of Shlomo, I think, is very interesting. He invokes Shlomo in particular. What does Shlomo represent for us? What is Shlomo to the Jewish people and Jewish history?
Success.
Success. Shlomo is the high point of Jewish history. There is a temple, as you know, there's a Beis HaMikdash. The Jews are in their land. The enemies are not able to defeat us. We are at peace. We have the respect of the world. Malachim Aleph Perek Yud, the 10th chapter of Kings 1, is the height of Tanakh. It's the high point. We have our own empire in our own land. The Queen of Sheba comes from afar because she's so impressed by what she's heard about Shlomo, and she hears about his great wisdom, and she praises the God of Israel. That's what we were going for. And then it all collapsed. And what he's saying is, that's what we're trying to recapture here. We want to regain the heights that we had in the time of Shlomo. Right? Even in the Gemara, when they talk about the great point of Jewish monarchy, it's Sudat Shlomo Bashato, the feast of Shlomo in his day. That's what we're trying to recapture. And he says, you want to know why Rome burned, so to speak. You want to know why it went down. It started this way. So if you do this, we're going to lose everything we're trying to achieve. And I think that's why he does this weird left turn and, you know, grabs a random example out of Tanakh. It's not a random example. He's grabbing the representation of everything he dreams of achieving. He would like to be Shlomo, essentially. Whether he wants to be king or not, we've discussed earlier on. But he would like to recreate that empire, and he says, you're undermining it. That can't happen. And so that's what he's trying to do here. We've seen so much in the course of the last 2 years. I've had a lot of fun with this. I think I enjoyed Eov more. But I want to thank you very much for sticking with it.
Thank you.
And I'm going to send out, God willing, in a week or so, I'll send out a link to a summary sheer that I'm going to record, just so we have to have some kind of summary of what we've done here. And then I hope you'll be back for Yeshaya, for Isaiah next year. Again, the plan is a 2-year gig. In which we're going to not do word by word, but instead I'm going to try to do themes chapter by chapter. There'll be an introduction in the beginning to the book overall, but then to try to do chapter or two at a time each week with some of the major themes that are in it, so that we can wrap, you know, 66 chapters over the course of 2 years. Thank you. Yes, go ahead.